This Is Money's podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. Check your financial products at FSCS Protected at fscs.org.uk/thisismoney.
Welcome to This Is Money. I'm Georgie Frost, and alongside me and editor Simon Lambert today for his first of the new year, Happy New Year, is assistant editor Lee Boyce. And, well, it was on the cards. Santander follows the crowd and slashes the perks on its super popular 123 account. But is this the death knell for bank accounts with benefits? We also look at the rise of buy now, pay later industry. We ask if you can get planning permission after you've built something you weren't supposed to, and give you five good reasons not to buy an SUV. And don't forget, you can stay up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk. or download the app. But first, let's think back, shall we, to the heady days of 2012, when someone called Got Your Feet Kimbra was number one in the music charts. Nope, me neither. And Santander stormed to the top of the current account charts with its brand new 123 account. Now, it quickly became a big hit with customers, with its offering of decent interest rates on large balances and up to 3% cash back on your household bills. Now, fast forward a few years to November 2016, the rate was halved. Customers were pretty angry about it. But fast forward again to the start of this week, and we got the news that not only is Santander slashing interest and cashback, but it's bringing in an overdraft rate of 39.9%. Now, the changes will come in May, and it's not just the 123 that is getting a bit of a shake-up. Why have they done it? And does this signal the end of accounts with benefits? Now, I want to ask you first about these accounts and Santander, why it's doing it, etc. And then we'll go on the issue of overdrafts, because I think that's a wider issue as well to talk about. Is that fair enough,
yeah,
lads?
Yeah, it's fair enough, Georgie. Yeah.
Excellent. All right, Lee. Tell us a bit more. I mean, let's go back to those heady days of Got Your Feet Kimbra. Or Santander, either way, launching this 123. How popular did it become? Why was it so popular? Why did it make so many waves?
Gotcha, by the way, was somebody that I used to know. You must remember
that
song. Yeah, I remember that song. It was everywhere. And this now is somebody that I used to bank with, potentially, for Santander.
How very Lee.
It was a hugely popular account, Georgie. So I'll take you back to 2012, when the day before it launched, I was actually in a round table discussion in which Santander had announced that the current account was launching the next day. And I remember it caused quite a stir with financial journalists, and quite a few of us were going, this sounds like it could be a current account game changer for people. And actually it was. 4 million people opened that account in 4 years. It's a million people a year, George, opened that current account. That is huge numbers. So they managed to get a number of current account customers from this. It was an expensive account for Santanderian to run. It was reportedly costing them £1 billion a year because of the interest, the 3% interest. What a lot of people did is actually started using it as a savings account. Rather than a current account, because you get 3% between £3,000 and £20,000, which is not to be sniffed at. Okay, at the time, rates were higher than they are now. So that looks really, really attractive when you think about it now, when we're at an age where easy access savings rates are 1.35%. Top, that's the best buy. So it was popular for that. It was popular with the cashback, which is actually quite easy to set up. So you could get up to 3%. It's tiered. So it's 1%, 2%, 3% on different types of bills. So you'd get 1%, for example, on things like council tax. You'd get 3%. Or something like your mobile. So it wasn't like you would have to go out and open all these things to get the cashback. You already had them anyway. They were direct debit set up from your account. And it was popular. At one point, I was looking through the figures, it was attracting five times the amount of current account switchers than the next nearest rival that was doing well. So you just it kind of gives you a flavour as to how popular the account was. It was massively backed by a campaign for sports stars, Jessica Ennis, Rory McIlroy. Spent a lot of money on it. They had attractive ranges of ISAs, mortgages, all that sort of thing. If you think of a current account like an anchor for a bank, it then tries to push all these other products on you. So it's perfect to get a current account customer in, because then they become a better target to get them to move the savings account with it, to get a mortgage, to get loans, all that kind of thing. So it was a clever move by Santander, but as I said, it was an expensive move. And it surely couldn't go on, I don't think, paying that kind of interest to the customers in Britain. So in 2016, it changed it to 1.5% top tier interest.
It blamed the rates then, didn't it?
It did. So interest rates were cut from, you know, for a long time, obviously they were 0.5%. They were cut for that period, 0.25% after the EU referendum. And they pinned it largely on that. They said it was, you know, untenable basically because of that. And it went down to 1.5%, 1% and 0.5%, but they didn't rename the account the 1.51, 0.5 current account for obvious reasons.
Yeah.
And they kept the cash back. The other thing they also did, when it launched, it was a bit of a novelty, really, in the fact that it was charging people £2 a month, just a kind of nominal fee. And then they hiked that to £5 a month. So it's still £5 a month. So it's slowly been chipped at. They've slowly made it less and less generous. It's done what it set out to do, and that is to hook in a lot of customers. A lot of customers will simply just still not bother switching away because they just won't. I think a lot of people still, we've had this conversation before, think that moving current accounts is a difficult endeavour and they just haven't got the energy to do it. But you can now, you know, vote with your feet if you're unhappy with this move. There's banks out there offering switching incentives. You'd get a higher rate of interest now on 20 grand on just a standard easy access rate if you shop around and get a Best Buy.
If they'd have done this alone, I would have said this is an incredibly dangerous move, because you've just said there they attracted those people who were switching, right? So they're the people who understand actually it's probably quite a simple process and are probably quite happy to do it again. The problem is, well, there's nowhere really else to go, is there, Simon?
Well, I think it's important, first of all, to not forget Jensen Button. And it was phenomenally successful. A great mark of whether a company has managed to successfully launch a product is when you start getting told about it by other people. So I'd be told about it by friends or family. Oh, yeah, I've got one of those 123 accounts. Yeah, it's really good. Yeah, well, with my 123 account, this happens. It's great to hear because it means people are engaging with their finances in a way, as long as it's something half decent that they've signed up to, which, you know, the 123 account was. And you always find it quite amusing as a financial journalist. You just nod along and go, yeah, that sounds really good. It sounds really good. Preaching, you're telling me stuff I know here kind of thing. But it's always really good. But they've, as Leek said, they've scooped up those customers now, but the banks don't seem that interested in scooping up any more. There was with the big banks and Building Society Nationwide, there was the current account with the big banks and the Building Society Nationwide, there was the current account wars, wasn't there, that lasted for a period of time. It coincided with the big drive to try and get people switching their bank accounts that then led to the seven-day switching service and all that kind of stuff. And you had these big guns offering big interest rates, big perks, big money to join. Everyone was offering free money. That's been whittled down steadily over the years. And as you say, where do you go now? The whole current account thing of I'm a savvy person, I'm getting loads out of my current account, really seems to have been fizzling away. And I guess, to be honest, one of the things that is probably affecting some of the decision making in some of the big banks, beyond the cost of running this, potentially the fact that they're not managing to cross-sell as much stuff or make quite as much profit from cross-selling stuff as they thought they might do, owing to changes in financial regulation that mean that you can't flog people investments in the way that you used to, crackdowns on money-spinning insurance that you used to sell to people, and so on and so on. And people are going maybe to the digital banks instead. Mm. I mean, look at the success of Monzo. On the same day that we're talking about Santander ultimately, you know, delivering the death knell for its once hugely popular account that will still continue to be popular, but why would you tell anybody to get it nowadays? You've got the Monzo maniacs on Twitter posting up their year in Monzo, where Monzo has cleverly said to them, you know, you can draw on your own data and it'll tell you where you spent your most money. And they've literally got hundreds, if not thousands of people advertising Monzo for free, yeah, out there on social media saying about how they went to Greg's 721 times last year.
I got that, but from Revolut. And I went, oh, my most popular shop was Target, you know, the American store. I thought, why on earth is that? And I thought, well, yes, because Revolut's the card that you have the currency converter. Yeah. That's why it's not really a bank.
So
I was tempted to mention that on social media and didn't think, you know, you were a free advert, isn't it, for them?
Oh, it's very clever. It was very, very clever. And that's the equivalent of all those people coming up to us telling us about their 123 accounts a few years back. So you've got Monzo, you've got Starling. You've got some of these other challenges. Someone was talking to me about N26 the other day. I don't know how many customers they've scooped up. And what's very interesting is there appears to be a little bit of a divergence in thinking amongst the banks. And I went to I saw an interesting presentation on this from a guy from Mintel talking about some of the banks, and that actually if you speak to customers and ask them what it is that means that they really rate their bank and that they would tell other people that they rate their bank, it's service, it's customer service that matters to them above all else. But what's interesting is the big banks appear to be pushing down the route of trying to digitize their customer service, i.e. more AI and chatbots and things like that. Well, digital banks are actually employing real people to be on the end of the phone and answer your questions 24 hours a day. So I do wonder whether we are seeing a little bit of a turning point in the whole current account banking thing at the moment that we might look back on and not say, oh, the, you know, knocking the 123 account perks on the head, that was the thing, that was what signaled it. But maybe when we look back over sort of this year, last year and the year to come, it might be that we go, oh yeah, maybe that was when these digital upstarts really did start to gain a march on the incumbents.
Lee, what are your thoughts on this? Are you a fan of accounts with benefits? I mean, is Simon right? Have we just, we don't need all that. We'd rather just be told how many times we went to Greg's.
Well, I definitely think there's something to be said for people that are savers, have money to save, just want a decent rate of interest. No bells, no whistles, just a steady rate of interest, you know, without all of this need for percentage back, cash back on bills and having to have hold large sums of money in your current account to secure an interest rate. Because at the end of the day, I personally don't like holding savings in my current account because I find it confusing. I like to have it in a separate pot, whereas a lot of people that are using that Santander account and maxing it up to 20 grand, having to make sure they're kind of keeping it at that level and whatnot. And it gets, I think, a little bit confusing. But that said, people like to feel like they're getting something for nothing. We are blessed in this country in the fact that, yes, we can moan about banks and whatnot, but we have free banking, I say with inverted commas, because obviously it is paid for somewhere down the line. And we're going to talk about overdrafts in a minute, which is a large part of that. But people like to feel like they're gaming the system almost with these financial firms. They feel like, yeah, I'm getting 3% interest on this balance. I'm getting cash back from just doing everyday stuff. So I think there is something to be said on it. But I do think that we are now on the cusp of a lot of generous offers disappearing, or we have anyway. Lots of banks have been rowing back, and I should point out with this Santander account that the interest rate's going down to 1%. A lot of banks don't offer interest on their current account balances. You can get 5% with Nationwide, but that's up to 2.5 grand. That will suit some people, and that's only for the first year. That will suit some people that will go, actually, well, I don't have large sums of money, but it's still nice to earn some sort of interest rate on it. And it has, it's capping its cash back, Santander, to £5 a month per tier, so up to 15 quid a month. Yeah, it gets a bit confusing, but what it's saying is that for the vast majority of its customers, something like 95% odd, it won't make any difference. But what it suggests is that some people were properly gaming the system and somehow, you know, getting more cash back than the average person, and have been quite savvy and have figured out ways of doing that. It's still a relatively attractive account, but I think it will just annoy people the way that this has been handled and the way it's been done. And you mentioned earlier, Georgia, they pinned it last time about interest rates going down from 0.5 to 0.25%. Well, they're 0.75% now. It's like, what are you going to blame it on this time?
Exactly. That's what the question I was going to ask you is, actually, what's the excuse now?
The excuse is just that basically they can't read in between the lines. Well, they can, and it's also things like they can't carry on offering, you know, for it to be sustainable. That was the words that the banking boss used, you know, to keep it sustainable for people. They're going to have to cut its rate. And you can, again, talking about savings rates have been dropping substantially the last few months. We've seen some real low rates being chopped here, left, right and centre. A lot of that's to do with the mortgage rate battle. And actually, Simon mentioned earlier about the current account battle. It was a great opportunity to raid the old stock image archive of pictures of things like Braveheart and all that kind of the current account battle. It was really good. Yeah. It was really, a bit like the ISA wars that we used to have. The cash ISA seasons. We've got, it looks like that kind of thing is going to be confined, I'm afraid, to nothing. It's gone.
Rubbish
done.
Pictures.
Yeah.
Pussycats
yeah,
and stuff.
Exactly. Yeah, nothing interesting.
No. Simon?
Well, I think that the question people have to ask themselves, if they have a Santander account, is there now anything keeping them with Santander? Are they happy with the service, as mm-hmm. we just talked about? Have they had a look at the numbers? Whether they're going to get enough benefit to outweigh the £5 a month that they are paying? Is there somewhere else that they think it might be worth switching to that suits them? For example, they'd like to, you know, try and get some interest on it. Maybe they'd just like to try out another bank and get a bonus for joining it. You can still get paid £100 for joining First Direct, which comes out trumps for customer service. I've been a First Direct customer for years, and the reason why I've been a First Direct customer for years is because the customer service is really good.
Yeah.
So they need to look at it and go, okay, was this just a chapter in my life that I'm going to close, turn the page on and move on to a new bank?
Yeah.
Or am I going to stick around? And so it's crunch time, make a decision and then, you know, stick with it. And if you do think, well, do you know what, this Santander account's all right. I quite liked it when I was getting the money, but now I'm hardly getting anything and it's not really worth me paying a fiver a month in order to do it, then why not try out another bank, open an account with another one of the big banks, or try out one of the challenger banks? I opened a Starling account this year, largely because I wanted to be able to spend overseas for free. And actually, the Starling account is considerably better than Monzo's for doing that. And it was absolutely painless. They promised to get you a debit card within 2 to 3 days, and they did. In fact, they got me it in less time than 2 to 3 days. App based, really easy to set up, worked great. Probably saved myself maybe £30 in fees when I was on holiday in summer. Got to be happy with that.
Oh, you're making me think, Simon. You're making me think about whether I should do it. But let's talk about the overdraft changes that have come in as a result of regulation, the FCA, all of that jazz. This, to me, sounds like a little bit of law of unintended consequences. Banks are businesses. They need to earn money. Where are they going to earn it? Boom. And you spoke about free banking, Lee. Really? Do we have it anymore?
Well, this is it. So there's always going to be winners and losers in these types of circumstances. So, for example, I have a credit card. I earn Avios points on that credit card, but it comes with an APR of something like 50-odd percent, right? So I have to play the game. I have to play the system. I have to make sure it's paid off. I pay it off every week to make sure that I don't fall into that trap. But for every 9 of me doing that, they're relying on one person not doing that and dipping into that APR, not paying it off in time. And that's how they are able to offer things like generous as points for air miles, right? So taking that into a current account situation, there are people that live in their overdrafts. It is a major problem. People, it may not be thousands and thousands and thousands of pounds, but can be from, you know, a couple hundred quid to a couple of grand. People that, you know, live from payday to payday. I've been there when I first started work. You know, I was living in my overdraft. I had a student overdraft. I found it very difficult to dig out of that hole. And that is kind of what the FCA regulation is meant to be cracking down on, to stop people living month by month, going back into that overdraft, getting charged for it, getting to payday, perhaps ducking back over the parapet and then back down there.
Which in theory is a great idea, right? Because it costs me money.
In theory, and actually a lot of the banks now are doing things like not showing your overdraft balance as part of your balance.
So when, so you don't
you
feel like it's your money,
so
right?
So you don't feel like it's your money, to try and prompt people into action. Unfortunately, though, what this has done, and the FCA actually came out and defended its move last week, because the press have obviously kind of not been too happy about what's been going on. A lot of them have set rates, a blanket overdraft rate.
What was the problem? What are journalists worried about? Financial
well, it's a 39.9% rate that most of the banks have opted to plump for. So when Nationwide first came out with it last year, we were kind of up in arms. Builders say 39.9% blanket overdraft. It's expensive, Georgie. It's a very expensive way to borrow. The argument is, and now lots of other, the big banks have kind of come out, mostly in between the 35 to 40% mark, it's meant to be a blanket overdraft rate for anyone that dips into the red to make it easier so people can actually work out how much they're paying rather than confusing day-by-day fees that some banks charge along with an APR. All that kind of thing, it makes it complicated. The argument is for consumers to work out how much they're actually getting charged for an overdraft week in, week out. This is meant to be making it easier, but what the real nub of this is, it's going to help out people that go really deep in the red. These are people that really are thousands of pounds in the red. They've gone way over, you know, into unarranged borrowing, and they're getting, because they've got a bigger amount of money in there, obviously the interest rate is huge and they might be getting charged, you know, 50 quid a month for borrowing this way. And it's trying to take those people really deep in the red to encourage them to get out of it. But the unintended consequence is people that are kind of going between naught and a grand into the red are going to end up paying much more for doing so. So it's going to penalise really the people that dip into the red a little bit, not too much, but it's going to help the people that get severely into the red. You could argue, in one hand, perhaps that's not a bad thing, but if it's going to hit more customers, it's going to make customers that they're trying to claw back. Basically, the banks are trying to claw back the money from people that are not going into too deep into the red to help those that are going really. That's where they're trying to sort of like row the money back from. And I'm guessing Santander haven't said this and we haven't put this to them, but I'm guessing part of this move is to do with that. You know, it's to help cut those costs, keep the current account profitable for them. And how this all plays out, a lot of these overdraft rates haven't actually come into force yet. They're coming into force sort of between now and May. And how it's going to affect people kind of remains to be seen. You know, all of
and we'll see the knock-ons elsewhere.
Exactly.
In terms of the
and of course, of the spill and all the chat has been, you know, very much defensive lines. You know, well, it's going to help out this percentage of people and this is how much, you know, they're going to be paying for an overdraft now compared to this. But, you know, at the end of the day, it doesn't read well, does it? 40% overdraft. There's much, much cheaper ways of borrowing. When you consider, at the moment, personal loan rates are pretty much the cheapest they've ever been. But now we're looking at overdraft rates of 40%. And we've got credit cards and things that are, you know, probably 20% APR. Overdraft borrowing is going to be way more expensive than putting money on a credit card.
I find myself in a rather awkward position, Lee, where I think I might be about to defend the sort of bank move in terms of helping those people who are in the red all the time. Clearly can't seem to... Simon, your face is absolute disgust. But then those sort of people that you say dip in every so often or, you know, to a smaller degree, I suppose like you and I mean, I was exactly the same, with that kind of threat of a 40%, am I going to be a little bit more cautious about whether I do dip in? Simon, you do not agree with a word I'm saying.
Well, no. I think maybe it would make people more cautious about it. And actually now that... So I've been getting text messages from my bank that tells me you're overdrawn and you're going to get charged X interest rate. So I quickly go put some money in from my savings account. Now, I think... I've got no problem with the banks being told that they need to get rid of these £1 or 50p a day or 75p a day charges that they had been imposing, that they had been charging some, and the key word is some of their customers, instead of an interest rate, APR-based rate. They cooked up these charges as a way of supposedly making overdrafts simpler for their customers. What they did was they didn't make overdrafts simpler for their customers. They made overdrafts considerably more expensive for their customers because what you're looking at is loads of people who will end up in their overdraft for maybe 5 days before payday, 10 days before payday. In fact, they may even end up in their overdraft for 5 days before payday when they don't need to be in their overdraft. They might have put money into a savings account that month, but rather than move some of the money back from the savings account into their current account, they'd rather go 50 or 80 quid into the red, 100 quid into the red, and then it will get topped up on payday and then they just have £100 less the next month. That is something that I will do. I would not put money into my... I will take as much money as I can out of my current account and put it into a savings account, and then I'll do anything I can to avoid putting it back in there because I'm like, that's the money in savings, I just want it to stay in there. If you're being charged an interest rate of 18% a month, yes, it's quite expensive borrowing, but 18% a month on a 100 or a couple of hundred quid is peanuts. Mm-hmm. If you're being charged £1 a day and you're spending 5 or 10 days in there versus the fact that you've borrowed 100 or 200 quid, you are paying through the nose for it. And one of the comments made about this was that in many cases, those £1 a day charges were more expensive than taking out a payday loan, that they were ridiculous. So the FCA decided that they needed to act on this. Now, I do not imagine for one minute that what the FCA was hoping for was for the banking industry to turn around and go, OK, well, we'll take away those £1 a day charges and we're going to introduce a standard rate of 40% on our overdrafts. I do not believe for one minute that that was what the FCA was hoping would happen. So I find it very disappointing that banks have done that, particularly at a time when borrowing is so cheap. We're talking about interest rates going down now rather than up. Mortgage rates are phenomenally cheap. Personal loan rates are phenomenally cheap. Banks are using this as a way of making money. But what they're doing is they're trying to replace the lost revenue from those £1 a day charges. But those £1 a day charges, they should never have brought them in the first place anyway. So I understand they're protecting their profits, but there's this constant cycle of banks trying to protect profits because they've lost a revenue stream that they should never have had in the first place.
Yeah.
Those £1 a day charges came off the back of them being told to clamp down on bank charges for unauthorised overdrafts, which they'd got into trouble about and nearly lost a case that saw them banned completely. And unfortunately, after many appeals, they didn't. And some of that money that they were cashing in on unauthorised overdraft charges was to make up for the fact that they weren't making so much money off mis-selling people PPI. You can basically go, you can jump back a step every single time. And the end, the most recent step that they've taken is turning around and going, OK, 40% overdraft rate. I don't know who sits down in a bank and thinks, I think it's totally OK if we just have a 40% overdraft rate. Who makes these decisions? Who sits there, puts their hand up in the meeting and goes, I know, guys, I know how to respond to this FCA thing.
Yeah,
let's take the overdraft rate.
We'll vulnerable.
Get rid of those daily charges because we've got to do it. Let's take the overdraft rate up from 18% to 40%. So it's now more than twice as expensive as the average credit card.
Yeah.
You know, that's my problem with this. And I think it's the FCA. The problem is the FCA does not like to mandate a certain rate. It didn't want to put a cap in. It didn't want to say you can't make it any more than 20%. You can't make it any more than 25%. But you just can't trust these guys to do the right thing. You just cannot trust them. And when you have a building society like Nationwide that is owned by its members and meant to be on your side doing this at the same time as it's cutting its members' savings rates, it's just a really sorry state of affairs.
I realise after listening to you, that was a lovely speech there, by the way, Simon. I rather like that. I wasn't actually defending the banks. I was defending the FCA's move. And yes, you've pointed out that actually, if you're going to bring that in, you need to think about the knock-on effects that that could have. Lee!
Yeah, definitely. And I was going to say...
Sorry, you look like you're... No.
All I was going to say is that if you find yourself in the scenario in which you can't pay off an overdraft... We mentioned there that there are cheaper ways of borrowing. You could have a look at an 0% balance transfer credit card because it's going to be a far easier way probably to pay off a debt if you're able to qualify for something like that. And also think that banks should be doing more to try and come up with some sort of repayment plan or something along the lines of those people that are £1,000 or more, especially in an overdraft and can't get out of it, can't see a way out. Surely it would be more beneficial to try and come up with even a step further to try and help these people get out of debt and stop living in their overdrafts or so deeply in their overdrafts.
Because actually what a lot of those people find if they do have big credit card debt or big overdraft debt, persistent debt that they struggle to get rid of, is that when they do go to their bank and try and get a personal loan in order to pay it off and do the right thing, they then get quoted a very high rate for the personal loan because those rock bottom personal loans that we hear talked about, they don't have to offer them to everyone. Mm-hmm. They only have to offer them to, I believe, 51% of successful applicants. So actually, the people who do finally decide to get a grip on their finances and do the right thing might end up getting quoted a personal loan with a 16 or 17% interest rate, which up until now, most of them have gone, well, I might as well stay in my overdraft. But now it's actually cheaper than their overdraft.
A lot of this, I just think, is to do with mindset, and eventually we'll get to some stage where we realise that, you know, that overdraft is not our money. You know, we've got the Gambling Commission saying you can't use credit cards to gamble, so, you know, you can't use debt, because they're not credit cards, they're debt cards. Maybe this is just about a national mindset of the way that we spend money. But, I mean, this leads us on quite nicely to another area that there are calls for more controls and checks and regulations on. Now, I have to confess, I am Not a big Love Island fan. I've never watched it. But I was interested to note, reading, that a couple of the ladies on it have got themselves into a bit of bother recently for some Instagram promotions of a company called Klarna. Now, people have been calling them irresponsible for advertising a buy now, pay later firm, which, and there are lots of them, which basically offers a way for paying for goods that covers a range of credit products. Now, there is definitely a problem with awareness. You've got some research in your article about this, of how they really work and the harm that they can do to your credit score if you don't keep up repayments on them. But can they really be accused of pushing shoppers into debt? Are we being a bit hard on the Love Island folk who are Instagramming stuff? I mean, things have changed that there's financial kind of stuff on Instagram. But anyway, Lee, help us out here. What are they? Who's Klarna?
I love that the fact you called them Love Island ladies.
Oh, okay.
It was kind of, I don't know. It's
what does one call them? Contestants?
The Love Island ladies.
Well, I didn't know if they were current ones. I didn't know if they were past ones, and I couldn't be bothered to find out.
You should have asked Simon and I, because we are keen Love Island fans. Morning we debrief, we talk about the show. No, I've never seen it in my life.
Right.
No,
I was all ready to ask you,
I don't really understand. But I did see, and basically this is a whole can of worms, a separate can of worms. In fact, that influencers are pushing certain products. There's been all of this about you have to use hashtag ad and all of that kind of thing. But obviously,
but this is another level,
isn't
it?
The followers of the Love Island ladies that you're talking about are going to be young, impressionable people who might not have the means to go on a big retail blowout. And the whole idea behind these firms is you can fill your basket, fill your boots, let's say a clothes website. You fill your boots, but you don't have the money in your account. Maybe you're in your overdraft. Maybe you're a couple of weeks away from payday, but you must just get those boots or that dress or that shirt. You can get it, and you can then pay it later. It's quite a simple concept. It's not something... It's just been kind of revolutionised in the way it's become more digital. So basically, before, it's like it's the equivalent basically of like a store card. It's very similar, but they've come up with ways to make it easier to pay. So you could pay back, say, in 30 days. You can split it over three payments. So if you spent 99 quid, you can pay 33 quid, you know, over the course of 3 months, which is quite handy if you just want it to come out of your payday. And you can have longer term financing options where you can split something, bigger cost items, over 36 months, whatever, a bit like a credit card. It's not that different. But it's attracted this new wave of the younger generations. And the problem is, it's being pushed down their throats, basically, I would argue. 6 million, do you know, 6 million Britons have used Klarna, which is the big one. We will talk about all of the companies that do this, but Klarna...
Astonishingly, I'll be honest
with you. Yeah, six million.
Especially when you say it's targeted at the young, because the way you've described it is, I mean, not that you've described it in a complex way, but, you know, it doesn't... Store card I can kind of get my head around, but, you know, a credit card I can get my head around, but what...
Yeah, but basically, that's if you're a couple of weeks away from payday, let's say you have a party to go to or something, you want this dress, you want it, you can get it now. It's that kind of must-have-now generation, isn't it? It's not a save-up-for-it generation. God, I sound like such an old man. But you know what I'm saying? It's like, before, perhaps you would have gone, oh, I want that couple hundred quid dress. I'm going to save up for it. Now it's, I can get it right now. I can get it delivered to my office, to my door, tomorrow.
And I imagine they make this super easy to do.
And it's super easy. It's soft search credit, and it's done easy. And there's big retailers have teamed up with some of these firms. So H&M's a big example. Not only can you do it online on H&M now, you can also do it in store.
Right.
So it's become a really, really big thing. But what, and if you do it in the right way, and you do, and you make the payments, the repayments, and it's all done. Actually, it can be a boost to your credit score because it's showing that you can meet those debt commitments.
Yeah.
But you have to be careful because if you do too many in a short space of time, it has the opposite effect because you keep on taking out short-term lending. But what debt charities are saying, and also partly my personal view, is that you can get in a vicious cycle of this because you've done it once and it worked, and you might do it with a couple more retailers, and then you're constantly juggling all of these different payments that you've split everywhere, and it might get a bit confusing. So you have to tread with caution.
And also, if you miss payments, of course.
And if you miss payments, you know, exactly, and you know, you could have a threat of, you know, debt collection agencies.
Are they making this aware to people enough?
I think not. And again, I'm not just going to pick on Klarna here. There are other companies, Layby, Clearpay. There are other companies that also do this, but I personally don't feel it's that clear. And actually, Klarna told us that they've never had anyone that's had a detrimental credit impact of this, which, you know, that's what they're telling us.
6 million people?
Yeah, in Britain alone. I mean,
it's impressive.
I find it hard. But the other thing I would say about this as well that is quite interesting is that these companies, kind of really make it quite clear to retailers that having one of these payment systems in place will boost the amount of spend that people make. So it's something like they'll spend double than they usually would, because they're almost just kicking the can down the road, so to speak, because whereas you might go, I've only got a couple hundred quid in my bank, so I can only spend 50 quid. They'll just go, well, I can pay it later, so I'll spend 100 quid instead. And so that's that kind of, it's almost
it's
like
the same mentality as cash to using a card,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. It's like psychological behaviours, basically. The people kind of more willing to spend more. That's like one of the main benefits of retailers using one of these companies. But I predict that we're going to see more stories about people getting into trouble with these kind of firms and struggling to make some of the repayments. But who knows? I mean, the thing is with Klarna, for example, it's worth $5.5 billion now. It's one of the tech unicorns.
And they've never had a problem.
And they've never had a problem, you know. And again, I'm not defending any company or any business here, but I will step in and say we haven't had anything come through from readers about Klarna that they've, you know, had anything. If you have, please do get in touch. But it's not so much that. It's more of the increased spend, and it's that more kind of people are just wanting it now and perhaps getting into a cycle of debt when they don't need to be. It's just another payment method. It's just another way to make you part of your cash.
Simon, we may hear stories about people getting into trouble. Will we hear more stories about regulators looking into this, you know, with more checks, controls, that sort of thing? Do they need it, or is it, nah, just leave it? Fine.
Well, I would imagine that there will be. I would imagine they're taking a look at this. It's a fairly fast growth.
So we'll discuss that in about 5 years, yeah?
Yeah, it's a fairly fast growth industry. The absolute key to this industry, as Lee suggested there, is the retailers, is the relationships. So where Klarna has been very clever, and the other companies have been very clever, is in striking up relationships with the retailers. The retailers are very, very happy to offer this to people because effectively there's a couple of options people get. You've got the buy now, pay later option, which defers it. So maybe you don't have the money now, but you might have the money after payday. There's the split the cost option, which is being pushed quite heavily. You know, buy it, split it into three more manageable monthly payments. And the retailers get to sell more stuff, a lot more stuff. Klarna, I think, has a relationship with ASOS as well. Klarna is interest-free. They don't charge you as a customer. They're charging the retailer, okay? So the retailers are literally paying for people to buy more stuff off them, okay? And that what that says is the state of the retail industry. Even some of the retailers who are doing quite well in the retail industry are getting involved in this. And when you've got an industry that is willing to hand over its meagre profits, you've got to bear in mind that, you know, clothes retail is not a high margin business. So if you're handing over money to someone who's making it so that you can sell more stuff, you're eating into those margins. It says everything that you need to know about quite how powerful these things are in terms of attracting customers and getting people to buy more stuff.
They've also been doing that with cashback sites as well. So this is not the first move that retailers are paying for people to come to them.
This is considerably more compelling for a lot of people than cashback. I mean, and there's two ways of looking at it. One way of looking at it, if you want to look at it in the most charitable sense, in the most positive sense, is that actually, for some things, people are making a sensible decision. If you have a large purchase to make, splitting it up and paying it off in monthly payments, and a number of monthly payments, is quite a sensible way to do things. Especially if you can do so without paying any interest on it. I mean, if you were going to buy a sofa, then and you're going to spend £600 on a sofa, paying that off £200 a month over 3 months, no interest, that's a very sensible thing to do. That was one of the driving forces behind the idea of the credit card, is that you could spread the payments on a big purchase. Of course, the credit card, one of the reasons why that became so popular, was because the credit card enabled people to buy more stuff.
Yeah, right.
And so what you've also got is that the rise of the Klarna-style companies is also a sign of just people living beyond their means. They don't have the money to pay for something, so they're finding a way of putting it on tick. And we've seen it many, many times before, and it's quite indicative of, you know, various things of a country of people who are not paid enough money to fund the lifestyles that they want to have. But not even just the lifestyles, even just to actually just fund their basic living Big argument on the radio this morning about this question around our, you know, new points-based immigration system and the income threshold for people who are considered to be highly skilled, and that it's set too high, and that the highly skilled people are earning less than that. Maybe one of the bigger questions we should be asking is, why are we paying highly skilled people so little money in this country?
A fair question. Talking about doing things now and dealing with the consequences in the future, though, Simon, I'm going to turn your attention, if it's all right, to the subject of, if you want an extension, I don't know, a new barn, heck, a new house at the bottom of your garden, if you've got the size of a field as a garden. But red tape, getting planning permission, palaver. Perhaps you could just build anyway and get planning permission afterwards. Who are these people, these 40,000 people over the last 3 years who put in retrospective planning applications? And could this be the tip of the iceberg, as some people have suggested? Because, of course, I mean, some people will just be gambling and not bothering doing it at all. And then other people will be trying to ride out this so-called four-year rule. So are these people absolutely nuts? So what's the four-year rule? And really, should you be doing this?
So the vast majority of people who build an extension, decide to build themselves a home or various other things, will get planning permission. They can also, you can also do a certain amount of extending under what's called permitted development rights, which actually have been expanded upon in recent years and allow you to build a quite sizable single-storey extension. They also allow you to build things that aren't connected to the house. There's rules about how high they can be if they're close to the boundary and stuff like that. So you can actually build a reasonable amount in this country on your plot unless you go too big or you are in the green belt, and then the rules are much tighter. However, there are lots of people who do end up doing stuff without planning permission. Maybe they build an extension that they thought they could do under permitted development and then they discover they can't. Maybe they are in the green belt and they think, oh, I'm never going to get permission for that extension, I'll just build it. Or maybe they live in a flat and they do something like replace something or build a small extension that they think is okay, but they've actually read the rules for houses, not for flats. So what you can do is you can apply for retrospective planning permission, and lots of people get it. There are some rules around it. The four-year rule is the rule to do with enforcement. So if you've done something without planning permission, then the council can make you tear it down in the greatest instant, or put it back to how it should be. And they have got a four-year enforcement window. But what you must have done is not tried to hide it. And there was a very famous story some years ago. A man, the wonderfully named Robert Fidler, who decided that he was going to build himself his version of a grand design in the countryside. It was a home that looked a bit like a castle-style home, and he hid it behind a haystack. And he fought for years and years and years not to have to tear this thing down. And the key element involved in it was that he was not able to benefit from that four-year limit on enforcement because he had hidden his castle in a haystack. Wonderful story.
Castle in a haystack.
And I believe that eventually he did have to tear it down. But for most people, you know, it's probably okay. And most of these people have probably just made a mistake or something like that. But there are a small minority of people in this country who firmly believe that the planning system is an ass and should not apply to them, and are more than happy to build without planning permission and then just tackle it when someone comes around and tells them that they've done something wrong, or hope they can get away with it. I would imagine that the key to pulling that kind of stuff off is either having neighbours who are a very, very long way away, or neighbours who you have a very good relationship with, or neighbours who just don't care. And depending on the area you live, you will be able to potentially tick one of those boxes.
Just to end that, Simon, I'll keep you up to date with Honeycrock Farm. It was in Surrey. He built it in 2001, did Mr. Fidler, the delightfully named. It was eventually demolished in 2016.
So is it called Honeycrock Farm?
Honeycrock. Croc, I mean, Croc
As in
Fidler.
Honey Crocodile?
Well, I mean, it could be Honey Crook Farm. But C-R-O-C-K, do we reckon that's Honey Crook? That sounds about right to me. Either way, it is no more.
Yeah, I'll tell you one of the problems with the planning system, though, and this is what leads to a lot of this stuff, is that a lot of people do not perceive the planning system to be fair.
Mm-hmm.
They get turned down for something, but they see someone else get away with something that's much bigger. They see a house suddenly pop up in the green belt up the road from where my mum lives. She lives in the countryside. She lives in the green belt. She was limited. My mum and my dad were limited on an extension they could do because of being in the green belt. Up the road, there was a place that was, it was a field, and it had some sort of sheds in it and something. And then they started building, and they maintained it was stables to begin with. Oh, no, they maintained it was a pig barn, right? Because they could have got away with building a pig barn, because that would have been a properly agricultural building on the fields. The thing about this pig barn is it was brick built. It had a tiled roof. It had windows.
Mm-hmm.
And then it had a front door.
Kitchen, bathroom.
I didn't go inside it, but, I mean, if you were a pig living in this house, you were...
A pig in muck.
Yeah, you were doing pretty damn well.
Pig in luxury.
And actually, it looked a lot more like a house with some stables attached. And so then they sort of admitted that, yes, it was actually... They originally built it as a pig barn, but then they converted it to stables. And then it actually emerged that it was a house. And the council told them that they had to tear this down. And whoever had built this appealed that decision. And it went all the way up to the Secretary of State level, not the actual minister deciding on it, but the whatever committee or whatever decides on it there. And their decision was that, yes, this should not have been built in the Greenbelt, because it was clearly, you weren't allowed to build stables because the rules were different for them and they would have needed a change of use for the land. But B, they weren't allowed to build a pig barn that looked like a house or a stable. And they definitely weren't allowed to turn it into a house. And this definitely was building on the Greenbelt when you weren't meant to build on the Greenbelt. And that the council were right to say they should rip it down. But seeing as it had now already been built, there didn't seem to be any point in telling them to rip it down. That's not verbatim, the judgment, but that was effectively the gist of the judgment. That person ended up with a house that I think, I don't know how many years later, they ended up selling for just a shade under £1 million in the countryside on a couple of acres of land. Now, anybody who lives in that local area will not have looked at the planning system and thought the planning system works well. So you could understand why a number of those people in the local area, next time they did an extension, could have possibly been tempted to just hope the neighbours don't complain. What's very important to note, though, okay, for anybody who is considering building without planning permission when they need it, is that you also need... There are building regulations in place in this country, and that is to ensure that something is built properly and that is safe and meets certain standards of safety and building, and those are very, very important, and places should be signed off by building control. And actually, there is no limit on enforcement on building control, so while you might get away with it on planning permission after 4 years, you won't get away with it on building regulations.
All right, well, let's put that aside, because while we do love talking about houses, we also rather love our cars. But I thought we were a nation of little runarounds. But no, apparently we've gone all Americana, and we're having a love affair with SUVs at the moment. Sales of the jacked up sports utility vehicles continues to grow at a faster rate than any other group. But why? But is the better question, why not? Because a consumer group which say there are plenty of reasons not to buy an SUV. Five of them, in fact. So, Lee, go through it for us.
It's just like a bit of a bigger hatchback for people that basically have families. That's kind of it, really. You can just shove more in it rather than... As someone that had a Ford Fiesta that was fine as being in a couple, then having a baby, Ford Fiesta wasn't as practical. Would have got away with it, wouldn't have been a problem. But we decided to upgrade and get an SUV. We've got a Skoda Croc. I don't see that as a jacked up sports utility vehicle. I just see it as a practical... Went away a couple of days last week. Could just shove everything in there, pram, all the bits of Bateman. Bateman is an incredible amount of stuff for being such a small human. Everything just gets bunged in the car. Now, what Witch are saying, and some of the big sellers of things like Nissan Qashqai, Ford Kuga, and actually, just to contradict the Witch research, the car of the year overall winner for 2020 is the Ford Puma, which has been relaunched as an SUV this year. So SUVs have become massively popular in this country, as you point out. Now, what Witch are saying, there's five reasons why they actually might not be the best buy for people. Number one is poor fuel economy. Right. That is true on some sports SUVs because, you know, the bigger cars, there might be more, you know, gas guzzlers. But it's not always the case. You know, as everything, you have to do your research. I wouldn't say that my Skoda Karoq has particularly got bad fuel economy. I checked out the stats.
But it will have worse fuel economy than a similar estate car.
Yeah, okay, well, that's a fair enough point. Yeah, I'm not disputing that. I'm not disputing that fact. Handling, apparently not as good handling as things like hatchbacks. Well, I just think that's kind of par for the course, really. You know, I think about my little Ford Fiesta, dragging around corners, you know. Yep. Lovely little vehicle that was. Too big for width restrictions. So basically, people just can't park properly, can they? So, you know, if you think about a car park in a town, they're kind of marked out for what was probably a standard car however many years ago. Where people are now getting bigger vehicles, those parking spaces have become a bit narrower for people. And if the person next to you's got an SUV and the person on the other side of you's got an SUV and then you're squeezing an SUV in, it could be quite interesting. And actually what I've noticed recently, and it's probably more just an Essex thing because people in Essex can be a rather selfish bunch. People sort of taking up two spaces to sort of negate the fact, which I just think is, you know, absolutely mad. But there we go. They emit more CO2. Going back to the sort of fuel economy argument as well, and they're less reliable on average compared to other cars. I think it's also worth pointing out that there's been this big thing in France about SUVs, and people that have quite fuel hungry ones are about to face very, very, very steep charges to have them on the road. Could that be something that comes over to Britain? Quite possibly. I'm not going to sit here and defend SUVs just because I've got an SUV. I think there's some good things about them. I think there's some bad things about them. But ultimately, you've got to do your research. You know, you can get something like a Mitsubishi PEV, the plug-in hybrid one, if you're really worried about, you know, okay, well, it's more of a 4x4 than an SUV. But, you know, bigger vehicles, there are options out there. They don't all have to be gas-guzzling, CO2-emitting, awful vehicles that, you know, the old Chelsea tractors is the thing that gets wheeled out, isn't it? Especially in this part of the world, in London. You know, people driving around in their Land Rovers and whatnot probably don't need it. And maybe it is frustrating when you just see one, just a solo person in there just driving it around. You think you could be in a Fiat 500 or something a bit smaller or an electric vehicle. But I think really it's up to the buyer, isn't it? If they want an SUV, there's a market for it. And car manufacturers, the last decade or so, 15 years or so, it's been the biggest growth market of cars. You know, people want them. There's demand for it. And that's the bottom line.
I have no problem with SUVs.
Good.
Or 4x4s. I love a good old-fashioned 4x4. I love a Range Rover. I love a Land Rover. I do think that the world has gone completely mad for SUVs, though. Lots of people are going out and buying cars that are jacked up versions of smaller cars. So for example, you get yourself a jacked up version of a Fiesta, you get yourself a jacked up version of a Golf kind of thing. People who would have just bought normal cars, or if they needed the extra space in the boot and the practicality, they would have gone and bought an estate car, they would have gone and bought a saloon car. Because sales have shifted so much towards it, car makers have started putting more effort into that and less effort into making what were considered to be before the mainstream cars. And it is a fact that basically cars have got hugely more efficient and much better at getting much more power from less in recent years, thanks to largely emissions rules and car makers being driven to do it. But almost all of those gains have been given up by the fact that people are going out and buying larger and heavier cars. And that is what the problem is with SUVs, is that they are larger and they are heavier, and they are, the fuel economy is worse, and the bad fuel economy equals more CO2 and bad for the planet. And it also leads to this scenario where people say, well, the thing is, I like the high up driving position because I can see above the traffic. And it's like, well, yeah. And then someone else says, yeah, but I like the high up driving position because everyone else has got that high up driving position and I need to see above the traffic as well. And you get to the point where eventually we're all going to be driving around in stilt cars in 30 years' time, which will be terribly, 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 terribly poor with their aerodynamics and much worse for the planet. So I think they should bring in a rule. Forget this banning petrol and diesel cars by whatever date. I want to see a rule brought in that says all SUVs must be pure electric after a certain point.
There you go. Simon has spoken. I was just going to ask if it's an element of keeping up with the Joneses. Have they become more reasonable, or is it the way that people are financing cars to pay for them now? Like, was it just a mix of everything?
But I would defend...
Or because they want to sit really high up?
I would defend anybody's right to buy the car that they want to. And everybody will come up with a good reason as to why they need one and why they want one. And it might, for some people, it suits them better actually to be sat up in that kind of high riding position. Some people live in the countryside; they do need to be able to get up a country lane on the odd occasion when it snows in this country. Just because it only snows twice a year, if you can't get home when it snows, that is a problem.
I have a bad back, in my defence, so a high driving position is actually very, very good for.
Can I just point out the SUV I have is incredibly small. I don't have a very, very high up driving position. I'm not a truck driver. I don't think I'm on the motorway listening to some tunes massively, looking down
at
people.
So you've not got a full Americana yet.
Look at me in my massive SUV. Look at you down there.
As someone who drives a fair amount of cars through the job, I will say that one of the small problems with taking a stance on against large 4x4s and the unnecessary proliferation of them is that when you then get into a large 4x4 and barrel around in it, it is really quite good fun.
All right, then. So, on that note, Lee giggling over there.
I'd say Simon's going to go out. He's talked himself into going to buy an SUV.
I've ordered a Range Rover while we're speaking.
There we go.
I'm going to Klarna it.
Right, you can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions or anything you want the team to investigate, Simon?
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you can come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to defend your choice of car in the comments.
Marvellous. And if you like our podcast, please do rate us on iTunes. It helps people find us.
This Is Money's podcast is brought to you in partnership with the Financial Services Compensation Scheme. Check your financial products at FSCS Protected at fscs.org.uk/thisismoney.